any of the tools we have could potentially damage the fossil if you're not careful, especially the little jackhammers that we use. Those can go right through the bone.
Mindy Householder is a fossil preparator on staff with the School of Mines and Technology. She demonstrates a pneumatic tool about the size of a thick pen.
It has air passing through it, and it functions more like a miniature jackhammer in that the tip moves up and down. It doesn't spin, so it's not a rotary tool. And this is, you barely even see it's moving, it's so tiny.
Part of Householder's job is to remove layers of sediment from ancient bone. She says she starts with much gentler instruments, like dental tools, and then works up to the tiny jackhammer if a more aggressive tool is necessary. A cautious approach is vital to prevent damage to rare fossils.
And you have to know what's under there and be able to anticipate it, I suppose.
Yeah, it's good to have a working knowledge of anatomy and to kind of have an understanding of exactly, you know, which way the bone's going to curve, or is it going to end here, or is there going to be a tooth there. Having that knowledge helps me to not destroy anything on accident.
Mindy Householder stands in a preparation room in the Paleontology Research Laboratory on the School of Mines and Technology campus. On a table before her are skulls of various sizes, many of them with the prominent teeth characteristic of saber-toothed cats or their distant cousins, nimravids. Some of them have been in storage for decades.
But what I did with these is I actually had to reverse a lot of old preparation from the 20s and 30s because they didn't. The art of fossil prep wasn't as advanced back then.
The thought process back in the older times of museum work was to try to make specimens look as complete as possible for viewers, because that would make them look more impressive.
Clint Boyd is a postdoctoral researcher at Mines. He says fossil preparation once involved a lot of artifice.
Anything that was missing on a specimen would be filled back in and covered. And in addition to that, they would take steps to make sure you couldn't tell what had been filled back in. And so they'd cover things over. In most cases, with these specimens, it was either plaster or wood putty. And then they would put a shellac mixture over it, which is like a glue. But then sometimes they would mix pigments into that. And what that would do then was it would cover it over so you couldn't tell where bone stopped and where the fake material started.
This well-intentioned cosmetic cover-up had the unintended consequence of concealing evidence of a brutal existence. Clint Boyd points out features in the skull of a Hoplophoneus, a nimravid whose name means murderous knife.
When Mindy cleaned this one up and cleaned off all these areas on the top of the skull where you couldn't even tell before that there had been plaster in, suddenly those holes took on very definitive shapes. And what we've ended up with is we've got nice puncture holes in the top of the skull that are actually from the teeth of other nimravids attacking this specimen.
After cleaning off more stored skulls, Boyd says researchers started to see a pattern. Those bite marks in the top of the Hoplophoneus skull were repeated in two more skulls.
A lot of these attacks are coming from behind, and they're being focused on the eyes. And sometimes, because you can see on this paired bite on the Hoplophoneus, one saber went into the eye, but as a side effect, the other saber went into the brain case. And so it's attacking the eye, but sometimes gets more than it expects when it's doing that.
Boyd says these attacks were not likely instigated by a hungry nimravid looking for food. He says a nimravid hunter would more likely go after the soft belly or neck of prey to protect its long teeth from breakage. But in a fight to the death, possibly over territory or leadership, the nimravid would have used all its weapons, including those long teeth, to bite the head and face of the opponent.
What we see in a lot of these specimens where we have good sets of bites, where we can actually trace the full dentition around, is that this wasn't, in most cases, two animals that were squaring off face-to-face and fighting each other. Most of these bites are coming from behind. And so either you're looking at a situation where, you know, one nimravid just didn't know the other one was there and got ambushed and attacked from behind, or they fought enough until one could pin the other one down and then they would bite at him from behind.
Boyd says because the fossils were hidden under layers of filler and finish, scientists lost good information for more than 90 years about the aspects of nimravid combat.
Having all these specimens together for the first time, and most of these specimens are specimens that Mindy discovered the bites on through preparation work, we had no idea that these were as common as they were, and we had no idea that we had consistent patterns until we started doing all this preparation work.
Part of the display is a cast of the nimravid skull found in the Badlands in May 2010 by Kylie Ferguson, a 7-year-old junior ranger from Georgia. That skull underwent a CT scan in February 2011 at Rapid City Regional Hospital, and from that scan, casts have been made. It was determined at the time of the scan that Kylie Ferguson's Nimravid also died from puncture wounds to the skull. Boyd says not much is known about Nimravids, who became extinct about 26 million years ago. He says we don't know if they were social creatures or whether they mated for life and such, but thanks to patterns found when the skulls were cleaned, we now know they put up a vicious fight. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City.